Yo. Hey, guys, welcome back to another awesome edition of the Best Practices Show. In my ongoing conversations with Dr. Jim McKee, who's an incredible mentor and a fantastic teacher, he shares some incredible wisdom today. There's a difference between financial freedom and financial independence. He walks us through that and how you can achieve both in dentistry. It is awesome. Please listen to this. I hope you guys enjoy it. We'll see you soon. Hey guys, welcome back to the Best Practices Show podcast. Are you a dentist and do you have a lot of school debt? And are you wondering, am I ever going to retire? Where does this go? How do I feel better financially? Well, today we're going to offer some great insight with a dear friend of mine, Dr. Jim McKee. And we're going to be talking about financial freedom versus financial independence. You're going to want to hear what he has to say. Jim, thanks for being on, brother. I always appreciate you.
Kirk, great to be with you as always. Always one of my funnest things to do. So I'm looking forward to this podcast.
Yeah, and I'm just going to tell you guys, I say this every single time he's on, one of the important pieces of this industry or this profession is getting around the right people. And we're going to bring you into the conversation, get you around the right person here. And Jim, we're going to go down this road and talk about this topic. Now, I did some research. The average dental school debt right now is $239,900, which is very interesting and way up. Let's first talk about the why and then what you're seeing in relationship to that debt. So tell us what we're talking about today.
It's interesting. When you start talking about debt, that's dental school debt.
Right.
Don't forget undergrad. Don't forget starting a practice. It's not uncommon for a dentist to be $500,000, $750,000, maybe even $1 million into debt before they have opened up a handpiece and worked on a patient. So the question becomes, again, how can we start to look at our finances? Because most of us really weren't taught a lot on the financial side. Most dentists were biology majors, chemistry majors, not a lot of accounting, not a lot of finance. And therefore, some of the financial parts are really kind of questionable in terms of how we understand that. I was a young dentist, and I bought a practice. It was a really small practice. First day in practice, I did an amalgam buildup on number 18 at 8 o'clock, and I did a root canal on number 14 at 4 o'clock. Those were the only two patients I saw all day. I always say I'm proud to say that the amalgam buildup patient is still a patient in the practice, and the endo patient is why I don't do endo. But what I started to realize after a little while is I really didn't have any plan for the future. So I didn't do much about it because, A, I didn't have any money to begin with, so I didn't have any money to invest. But I had no idea about thinking about retirement planning, about how do you save. And I went to a lecture once, and I can't remember who it was, but there was a discussion about financial freedom versus financial independence. And I did not understand the difference between the two of them. I thought it was one and the same. Financial freedom is basically having enough money to live on so you don't have to dip into savings. So you can afford to pay your monthly bills. You might have a little left over, but basically you're free financially. You're not having to take loans out, borrow money to live on a month-to-month basis. Financial independence is something completely different from that. Financial independence is where you don't have to go to work. And basically what it comes down to is you've either saved enough money or you've got enough money in your investments that are coming back to provide you income, so that it doesn't really matter if you work or not. Now, some people will get to financial freedom early in life. Some people will never get to financial freedom. Same thing with financial independence. Some people will gain financial independence early in life. To be honest, most people, especially dentists, many times don't realize that till later in their careers. And I guess the part that I want to emphasize is it doesn't happen without planning. It's not just an accident that you got out of bed one day and you're 60 years old and you go, hey, I've got enough to retire on. I think I'm done. I think that requires an active thought process as well as working with professionals, not different than our interdisciplinary team of people who we work with on the financial side to make sure that we can have enough to be able to support our families. We might be able to contribute to our kids going to college. We're going to be able to save enough so at some point we can retire and not have to work to work 90 to be able to pay off all that debt. So that's the difference between financial freedom and financial independence. The goal is financial independence. But honestly, when I look back at some of the funnest times over the last 35, 40 years I've been in dentistry, the financial freedom part's a lot of fun too. Right. Once you start to build a practice that can support itself, the excitement that I got out of that, I loved it. You know, we transitioned our practice. My wife is a dentist also. We transitioned our practice 3 years ago, but I never minded the management of the practice. I actually enjoyed it because I realized that that was part of my responsibility. Basically, what we had was a small family-owned business. And someone has to provide the leadership.
Right.
The difficulty is a lot of times doctors aren't trained in that, which is why consultants like ACT Dental can be so valuable to fill in the missing pieces that we didn't get because most of the time we were in science classes. We didn't have any human resources classes. You didn't have management classes. We were trying to make sure that we could get through the science courses to be able to go to dental school. That's why I think if you can get a good consultant and there's a big picture plan that you have worked out with the consultant, that can be worth its weight in gold. Because what it does, it creates an opportunity for you to cut through some of the underbrush that you weren't really trained in anyway and go right to the meat of the matter and get to the point where you have to start creating a solid financial future for yourself.
Yeah. And I'll piggyback on that. I have a great financial guy early on in my career when ACT was just getting going. He was so good at helping me understand. Like I was so worried about my returns and what I was, he's like, listen, your single biggest investment is not the money we've got here. It's this business. Like if you can get the yield where it needs to be, now we have more to play with. And so if you're a dentist thinking, well, I don't know how I can improve my investment, I think one of the things is, where's the money coming from? Let's get that healthy. Then let's get some advice on where to put it, don't you think?
I totally agree. Let's talk about that for a second, because I think that's a key point.
Right.
Because I think as a young dentist, especially someone who came from a middle class at best background growing up, a lot of times we're not comfortable with money. We don't know what to do with it. And I think there's a glamorous part of investing where you think you're going to put your money in, you're going to double your money in 3 years. And you know what? I saw a lot of people double their money in 3 years. I saw a lot of people lose their money in 1 year.
Right.
And so I guess my advice to younger dentists, don't go for the huge return immediately. Basically, if you look at what Albert Einstein called the greatest invention of the 20th century, it's compound interest. If you can build a balance of a retirement portfolio that's going to grow on an annual basis, it doesn't have to grow a ton the first year. What you want it to do is to grow a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more. Because basically there was something that I heard when I was young that was called 1-to-1, 2-to-1, 3-to-1. Have you ever heard of this?
I have, but I want you, I think I know where you're going with this. So explain that. So
basically, it comes down to the return you get on the money that you invest. 1-to-1 is, let's say you invest $100 and the return you get back from your investment is $100. So you're putting in 100, you're getting back 100. It's a 1-to-1 relationship. Roughly, That takes anywhere, depending upon your interest rate that you're getting your investment on, generally 8 to 10 years. So you have to be willing to put the time in when you're young to get to a point where you can build up a nest egg that's going to spin off a return that's equal to the amount that you're putting in each year. What I learned is that that meant I couldn't go for the huge return, because if I lost it, I never got to the one-to-one point. And when I look back at my friends in dentistry who've had a difficult time financially, it's always they went back and forth between zero and one-to-one, because they never got the nest egg big enough to get to one-to-one. The beauty of one-to-one is, let's say if it takes you 10 years to get to one-to-one, it might only take you another 5 years to get to 2-to-1. 2-to-1 is now you're investing $100 and your return is $200. Now, that may not sound like a lot, but here's where it gets exciting, because we're used to thinking about it like a linear line. This is a parabolic line. If it takes you 10 years to get to 1-to-1, it takes another 5 years to get to 2-to-1. From there, 3-to-1 is probably 3 years away. 4-to-1 is probably another 3 years away. 5-to-1 is another three, and it just starts going up and up and up. When you get to that point, you don't have to work as hard, because now the money is doing the work for you. Mm-hmm. The problem is you have to have the discipline, A, to put the money away, and B, to make sure that you can manage your portfolio so you can get to 1-to-1. The faster you can get to 1-to-1, the faster you're going to be financially independent. So for me, that was a huge thing to learn, because I think as a young dentist, you're thinking, oh, there's always time to save money. Right. And there is time to save money. But the problem is you lose the ability to generate interest from your money you've already saved if you push that off deeper into life.
Yeah.
So that's, I'm really lucky. My wife and I feel the same way, because sometimes you'll get one spouse who wants to spend more and one spouse who tends to want to save more. Yeah. So if you're married, I would make sure you talk to your spouse and come up to an agreement on how you want to handle your finances. We're both savers, so it worked out well. If you've got two people that are spenders, you got to be a little bit careful with that. And I've had a lot of friends who are in that situation. Yeah. Now, you can do that, but it causes some complications in the practice, and we'll talk about that.
Yeah. Now, one thing, we didn't talk about this before we hit the go button, too. You don't hear this chatter as much anymore, but no. I was a big fan of dollar cost averaging. So if you're not really smart, that 1-to-1, 2-to-1, you can't treatment plan when that's going to happen ultimately, because right. There's changes in the marketplace. But if you can start by getting your practice organized, making sure that you're taking 10% off the top, maybe a good start, and then getting aligned with your spouse. Here's another sidetrack too. This is not something I'm an expert on. I love my wife, been married for 25 years, but I also would say this, getting a really good babysitter is an amazing investment. They're cheaper than divorce attorneys and, psychologists. So and the reason I say that is it's heartbreaking. I hate it when it happens, but I have dentists that get divorced and it's extremely expensive, as you can imagine. Your entire plan goes out the window, and they never wanted to get divorced, and somewhere along the way it went bad. So this whole podcast is to help you on every front. So I'll just park that there. But if you're ever thinking you don't have time to have dinner with your spouse, that's not a good part of your retirement plan or long range plan. But go back to dollar cost averaging. Are you still a fan of that? I in the 1-to-1, 2-to-1, 3-to-1?
I really think the most important thing is getting the money in.
Yeah.
Get the money in.
Yeah.
If you can, and it doesn't have to be a ton of money either.
Right.
It doesn't have to be a ton of money, but make sure that you get in a habit of saving and just put it in. Make it part of your office overhead, that whatever percent of your profit that you can do that with, do that. Now, here's the problem. There's two areas that's going to impact. The first is the office. Because what I have seen is I have seen dentists who actually are pretty conservative people spend like drunken sailors on equipment in their practice, and they never use it.
Right.
If you're going to buy a piece of equipment for your practice, whether it's a cone beam CT, whether it's a laser, regardless of what it is, make sure that you have a way that you will be able to pay for the equipment. So there has to be a way that all of a sudden this equipment now you can get a return on investment in. People say, you know, I've always been into imaging. I had a Panorex when it was really not common for people to have Panorexes. I got a CBCT early in the game. But what it allowed me to do was being able to now understand dentistry enough where I could charge a fee for my services differently. So whatever office equipment that you are going to get, make sure that you have thought it through on how you're going to A, pay for it, and then B, create a way where now it can increase the resources in your practice so you can have enough time to, again, take time off so you can spend vacations with your family, so you can put money away, so you can go to continuing education. You know, I think we might have said this in one of the previous podcasts. When you look at the return on investment, when I look back, out of anything I've done, the return on investment on continuing education has given me the best return, and second place isn't close. The reason is really what it did, it's what you said before. It built the business. It allowed me to treat patients at a different level that I couldn't do earlier because, quite frankly, I didn't have the skill set. I didn't understand MRIs. I didn't understand CT scans. I didn't understand occlusion. I didn't understand restorative dentistry. I didn't understand treatment planning. Once I was able to listen to some of the giants in our profession, Pete Dawson at the Pankey Institute, John Coyce, Frank Spear, Vince Kokich, you know, I could keep going. I've been so fortunate to be influenced by so many of the fabulous teachers in our profession. But really, from a practice management / financial situation, it allowed me to have a return on my investment that A, allowed me to do other things, but B, it stimulated my interest in learning because, again, I could see the impact it was having on the practice. So in terms of the office, my advice is be careful with equipment. Now, I certainly think you need the most current and technologically up-to-date equipment you can get, but be smart about it. Make sure you're going to use it. Make sure you're going to be able to get a return on it. The other thing is continuing education. I want to talk a little bit about continuing education. Part of the difficulty, I remember going to continuing ed course real early. And I remember I was disappointed in the course. I was too young to realize it, but basically it was a very low-cost CE course that was sponsored by a company. So it was great because I got information, but I felt like it was an infomercial and I was being sold things. My advice to you as a young dentist is you can go to commercially influenced CE, and sometimes that's not a bad thing because it does expose you to new ideas. But what you have to really be crystal clear on is that if you're going to commercially based CE, there's an implied message in the material a lot of times. Not always, but a lot of the time if it's a CE that's put on by a company that produces products or something like that. So if that's the case, I would look for CE that is non-commercially biased. Now, that may be hard to do, and you may have to ask some questions before you sign up, but that's okay. Because in my mind today, I don't want to have to sit and think if the person who's presenting the program really believes that and this material really works in their practice, or They're saying it because they're being paid to do the presentation that day by the company.
Right.
So that's why, you know, I've always been drawn, you know, when you look at continuing education, I think there's multiple types of continuing education. There's study clubs, there's national meetings, there's workshops at teaching centers. They all can be great and they all can be really poor too. It really depends. My advice, again, I like bigger meetings like American Equilibration Society, American Academy of Restorative Dentistry, any of those that you'll have now that expand your thinking. Now, with those, some of those bigger meetings, sometimes you do get commercial influences, and that's okay, as long as you understand it. The other types of meetings, though, again, the more smaller hands-on courses, more of the lecture courses, I really prefer to have those non-commercially driven. You'll have sponsors there who help pay for things, and I get that. But the reality is I don't want the person talking to me giving me an infomercial about a certain company. I want this to be an accurate reflection of what their information and their practice is. So before I commit to a CE course, I'm doing a little bit of background to see how commercially it influenced it is. So that would be my goal. But the other thing for CE I'm going to really strongly, strongly recommend is that either take an afternoon or maybe take a full day after a CE course and make a to-do list.
Yeah.
I would do that every time. I would stay an afternoon, an extra afternoon at Panky, and I would go to the beach with a legal pad, and I would write down all the things I'm going to change in the practice. Because what happens when you come back from a CE course?
You're distracted. You're distracted. You're on fire. And they're like, oh my gosh, he's on fire. Let's distract him. He'll forget where he was last Friday by Wednesday.
We'll talk over there, and by Wednesday, he'll have forgotten it all. Make sure that CE is an investment in your future. If you don't implement it, simply is an expense.
Right.
Make an investment in your future that you'll get a return on investment on. I promise you, there's nothing, stocks, real estate, whatever, that's going to give you a return like investing in yourself and increasing your knowledge base through non-commercialized CE.
Yeah. Because when you go to the first course that you enjoy, you're not getting a 1-to-1, you're getting a 2-to-1. Then when you go back again and again, now you're getting a 3-to-1. Now it takes a while to adopt a lot of this information. You got to see it, you got to fail at it. And ultimately, when you go, sometimes, would you agree, Jim, sometimes when you get advanced in the CE, you're like, oh my gosh, I've got a patient right here, right now, that this person's talking about, and it helps you through it once, and then collectively that wisdom is incredible at continuing your career.
I was amazed when I went to hear Pete Dawson talk for the first time because he had all my failed cases in his lecture.
How did he do that?
How did he get my slides? Well, back then I wish I could say I was taking pictures.
Right.
But really, I think that CE can be kind of intoxicating because you get really excited. You get really hyped up about doing things. CE without implementation is a nice day out of the office, but not much more. So I'm going to really challenge you that when you go to a CE course, you need to come home with a to-do list. Mm-hmm. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. Might be 4 things long. It might be 40 things long. But you need to come home with a to-do list and an action plan in order to really, I think, gain the full benefit of continuing education.
Yeah. So you talked about office overhead, and then you also mentioned personal overhead. Speak about that.
Personal overhead has been really funny to watch. You know, I've looked at friends who got out of dental school. Immediately they bought the big house. Immediately they have the lake house, they've got all the toys. That's great if you can afford it. I was never in a position to afford that. We lived in a really modest house for the first 20 years we were married. Then we ended up moving to a different house. But really, I guess my advice to you, as I said, keep your office overhead down. keep your personal overhead down too. You don't automatically have to have the country club. You don't automatically have to have the lake house. You don't automatically have to have the brand new car, the big house. Keep your overhead low. Live in a more modest house if you can. You don't have to drive a brand new car. There's plenty of cars you can drive again if you're in the saving years. So my point is, don't put yourself in a bind at the office, because if you keep your personal overhead low, it allows you to now talk to your patients in a different way. You know, Dr. Pankey said something once that can never be more important for the dentist to have the patient accept the treatment plan so the dentist can pay their bills versus the patient accepting the treatment plan so they can get good dental care. Mm-hmm. The other thing he said, it's always easier to walk into a consultation with a few dollars in your pocket. And I have found that to be completely true.
Yeah.
When I look at the dentists who have struggled financially, many times it's difficult for them to give their patients choices because they need their patients to accept a certain treatment plan. If you can get to the point where you can say to the patient, we have different options to do this, and obviously I'm going to recommend the best option for you. If you're not able to do that now, we have other options, and they do come with risks. So we need to make patients understand that if they can't do the option we recommend, that's okay. We can phase the treatment, but it may end up costing more in the long run, and you may end up having clinical issues that we weren't able to recognize at this time based upon the age of the dentistry that we're doing. But we'll do our best to take care of that. You know, it's interesting because I think a lot of times what dentists do, especially young dentists, when you present a treatment plan and you've just got a bunch of new information, everything gets funneled to that discussion.
Right.
And I think you have to realize that there's a time when patients are ready and when patients aren't ready. That should be another thing. When do you present the treatment plan? You want to make a note on that for a future podcast?
Got it.
Because the mistake I made, thanks, Kurt. The mistake I made is I came back from Dawson with a lot of information. I mean, really, really good information. And when I put a treatment plan together and put together the case, if it was a treatment planning course in dental school, I would have got an A+ on it. Problem was I got an F with the patient because they walked out of the office without accepting care. I didn't meet the patient where they were emotionally, psychologically, financially, lifestyle-wise. I just simply looked at information that I had collected from an exam and I gave the answer.
Yeah.
You can do that, but now what I'm more likely to say is this something you might want to do all at once, or would you like to break this into different pieces? We can do it either way.
Right.
Give people choice, but it's easy to do that if you have choice in your life.
Yeah, so speak to that word choice. So the first one is you can give patients choices. That's one piece. Once you start to do what Jim's talking about, you now have choices. You have choices on days that you can work. And here's one of the biggest choices, and you've been through this. Tell me about this. As a coach, I get this all the time. There's two types of practice sales: the dentist who needs the money and the dentist who doesn't need the money. Those are two completely different transitions. Can you speak to that?
It is, you know, and it's interesting because, again, if you're a dentist who's looking to sell their practice, now you're under a little bit of pressure. You have to find the right person. You have to get the fee that you want for the practice. If you need that money to retire, the deal has to go a structured way. If you're able to have enough resources where you don't really count on the practice sale of your practice, which is honestly, when we were getting out of school, we were told not to count on the sale of the practice. So I never built that into my financial numbers. if you can, all of a sudden now what you can start to do is you can start to figure out what you're looking for in your practice. Main thing is, if you're looking to transition, do you want to stay on or do you want to walk out the door immediately? There's a couple of different choices there. I wanted to keep practicing, so I wanted to stay on. And I also think that our practice was a little more unique than others, given the amount of joint reconstructive work we see. So it would be hard for someone to walk right in who doesn't have a lot of experience in that and jump right on it. So for me, I wanted to continue working. It all depends on what's best for you, though. Sometimes when you know, it's interesting. I've seen a lot of dentists who said, I'm going to work till I'm 75. And all of a sudden they're 65 and they say, you know what? The switch flipped.
Yeah.
So I'm not as anxious to go back to the office. I'd rather do things outside the office. You know, I'm really lucky because my work schedule now is 6 to 8 days a month. I mean, it's perfect. Now, the difficulty is doing that, though, is when you sell a practice, here's the problem. Problem is there's usually not enough dentistry for the buying doctor as well as the doctor who sold to stay there 6 to 8 days a month, because the production that I would be doing in that time is being pulled away from the dentist who just bought the practice who needs to pay off all the loans.
Right.
So in the restorative diagnostic practice model that we've talked about before, I was able to build a restorative diagnostic practice model of TM joint diagnosis and occlusal diagnosis. It worked out great because there's a never-ending number of patients, so I could easily stay busy 6 to 8 days a month, even on top of what's happening with the person who took over the practice, so we can both be busy enough to make it work. The reason why most practice transitions don't work if the selling dentist wants to stay on is there's not enough dentistry for both of them to do.
Right.
For the dentist who's buying the practice to be able to meet their obligations. So I'm going to suggest to you, if you can build a practice that we've talked about in terms of diagnosing joints, treating occlusal problems, stuff that a lot of people don't want to do, it really gives you a leg up on building a unique practice that patients or dentists will both seek you out as time goes on.
Yeah, so well said, Jim. Now, I know I can't keep you all day. I would love to. But give us some final thoughts on financial freedom versus financial independence.
Final thoughts, honestly, I've never been really a money person. I like experiences more than I like money. Now, you have to have money to do experiences, so I don't want to sound totally naive about that.
Right.
Some people get wrapped into the money part of it, and that's okay. Some people like to do that. Some people check their investments all the time. That's not me. I want to make sure that I have enough where if by chance I had a slow month at the office, or if I wanted to take 2 weeks off and do something with Lisa, that either one of those I could do and not be materially affected. Now, that didn't happen in the early years, so I don't want to have this be a pie in the sky discussion about, oh, everything will be fine. That's not the way it is. You got to have a plan. You got to have a plan that you're looking to save each month. You have to have a financial advisor that you trust. And my advice, again, would be to start out relatively safe and let it build. Once it builds and you get to 1-to-1 and you want to try a few other things, try it. But again, the whole goal is to get to 1-to-1 and not slide back and forth with all that. So my advice to you is to make it part of the journey. Make it a fun part of the journey. Don't be crazy. It doesn't mean you can't ever spend extravagantly, but I don't think you can do it every weekend.
Right.
So I guess my point is, yeah, there's special occasions. Do something special. But the most special occasion that you get, well, I remember this happened, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago. Underneath the tree, Lisa had wrapped up the title for our house because we had paid the house off. Those are the fun things that you get, because what that does, that starts to take away some of that anxiety at the office if the patients say yes. Here's the crazy thing. The older you get, I think the more patients say yes, simply because you're not strained financially anymore.
Right.
I think patients pick that up.
Yeah.
That I have to do this treatment because the dentist needs to be paid. Right now, I'll tell patients, it's totally up to you on what you do. I'm going to tell you what I think is best for your mouth. I'll give you the pros and cons of different options, because there's always more than one way to treat a case. We'll talk about the realistic ways to do it, and I'll talk about the positives and negatives for each of those, because generally every treatment option is going to have a positive and a negative.
Yeah.
So we need to talk about that. Now, most of the time, if we have good biology, we've got basically good bone support, good gum tissue, we don't have infected nerves, we've got all our teeth, we can do some really good dentistry if we have healthy joints. Because if that's the case, we've got the back end of the system covered, we've got the front end of the system covered, then we just have to figure out how to make it fit. The problem is, well, something doesn't fit either at the back end of the system in terms of the condyle disc assembly, or at the front end of the system where the teeth over-erupt and they're in crossbite and everything's complicated. So that's why I'm saying, I think if we can recognize the patients that we can treat confidently, set a fair fee, take some of that and put that away for retirement, things will take care of itself.
Yeah, I love this, Jim. And then also, you know, you don't want to be pulling a heavy weight when you're in your 50s. I think there's some natural concessions that come along, like that gift you got underneath the tree. You know, us having four kids, we have one kid left in the house. It's amazing how much lighter the load is. So there's some concessions along the way. If you stick to the plan, you're going to be like, wow, this isn't as hard to tow anymore, right?
That's exactly what happens. That is exactly what happens. All of a sudden now you maybe don't have to work as many days a year. Maybe instead of working 8 to 5, you can work 8 to 2 as you get older. Again, at my age, still being able to have the excitement and the ability to practice dentistry is really fun. You may not have that either from an excitement level or a health level. So that's why it's nice to be able to have those ducks in a row financially in case you do have something, then you're like, okay, I'm good anyway.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm saying, I think the independence that it gives you both psychologically and from a living perspective really makes it a noble goal, I think, to achieve.
Yeah. Jim, this is so awesome, buddy. I know I got to let you go here, but we're going to have you back again and again and again. And I actually wrote down that topic for that show. So stick around while we say goodbye to everybody else. Thank you guys for listening to the Best Practices Show. This is great advice. Jim is not only a smart man, but he's a caring man and he's very wise. You'll see a lot of the people we have on the podcast, they have this thing called wisdom, which means they learned about it, they tried it, they also failed, and collectively that adds to what's called wisdom. And you guys got a bunch of gold today. So if you can follow some of those elements of his wisdom, I promise you, you'll be on the road to a better practice and better life. So keep tuning in while we keep exploring other topics. I love how this is all working. Thank you guys for all the suggestions. But until we see you guys next time or you hear from us next time, keep watching or keep listening to the Best Practices Show. You guys enjoy your day. So there you have it. Another great episode. Hope you guys enjoyed it. Hey, and thank you for showing up. I just want to thank you for being here and sharing the good word with your friends. And if you're really enjoying the podcast, could you do me a favor? Could you go to wherever you consume the podcast and just give us a 4 or 5 star review? Here's what that does. It allows us to find other great people like you. I love this profession so much. I'm going to spend the rest of my professional life finding great information so that you can consume it and your friends can consume it so that you can create a better practice and a better life. So keep spreading the word and we will see you guys soon. Have a great day, everybody.